Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was 1946, and Sergeant Isaac Woodard was almost home from his service in the Philippines during World War II. That journey was to have ended in Winnsboro, South Carolina, but he got into an argument with the Greyhound driver, and as the bus passed through Batesburg, Woodard was removed by the local police chief, who then assaulted him, leaving him blind in both eyes. Segregation and Jim Crow were thriving throughout the South, and indeed the nation at the time, but this incident spread like wildfire across the country, thanks to the attention paid to it by the NAACP, who brought it to the attention of actor Orson Welles, who hosted his own national program on ABC Radio.
The blame belongs, as I say, in Batesburg, South Carolina. It was Monday, February 13th, 1946. A minister and several workmen saw the police chief of Batesburg and a highway patrolman pouring buckets of water over the head and body of a soldier who had been arrested the night before. What the policemen were washing away was blood. And between each bucket, they stopped and asked the soldier, "Can you see yet?" Each time, the soldier answered, "No." The soldier was a Negro. We know now that his name is Isaac Woodward, and that the police chief had beaten him the day before and blinded him with a blackjack. When I stumbled on the story several months later and brought it to public attention on this program, the name of the guilty policeman was unknown, and it looked as though it always would be. I promised to get that name. I have it now. The minister and the workman provided our investigators with one clue, and there were other clues. All led to a single man. All clues led to Mr. M.L. Shull, chief of police in Batesburg, South Carolina. Now we have him. We won't let him go. I promised I'd hunt him down. I have. I gave my word I'd see him unmasked. I have unmasked him. I'm going to haunt Police Chief Shull for all the rest of his natural life. Mr. Shull is not going to forget me. And what's more important, I'm not going to let you forget Mr. Shull.
Extraordinary. Orson Welles. A white judge, J. Wattis Waring, would preside over the trial in which the jury acquitted the police chief, but the judge was so shocked by the incident and what he viewed as a miscarriage of justice that he began to study race relations in the country, going on to issue major decisions on voting rights and segregation, which paved the way for later decisions by the Supreme Court that would reshape the nation. Judge Waring's story and that of Isaac Woodard are now being told by another judge, Richard Gergel, who works in the same courthouse where Judge Waring once served. His book about this chapter in our history is called Unexampled Courage: The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. And Judge Gergel joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Nice to have you here. This incident occurred at a time when lynchings were still going on, when black people had very few rights, when they were grossly mistreated on a regular basis.
And right. Remember now, we have 900,000 African-American soldiers returning from World War II.
Exactly.
And their families could not vote. In the South, 75% of African-Americans lived in the South.
So what was it about this incident, with all these other things going on in full view of everybody, what was it about this incident that inflamed Orson Welles and through him captured the attention of President Truman?
Well, it's a fair question, because there were lynchings during this period.
Right.
There were other episodes of racial violence resulting in death. Isaac Woodard did not die. He was beaten and blinded. But there was something about this incident. It occurred on February 12th, 1946, the day Sergeant Woodard, a battlefield-decorated soldier, was returning home from World War II. He was still in his dress uniform with sergeant stripes on his shoulder and battlefield medals on his chest. And he got into a dispute with a bus driver because he thought the bus driver had spoken disrespectfully to him, and he wasn't going to tolerate it anymore. Basically, he was returning. He wanted to be part, as these other returning African-American soldiers, they wanted to be part of America's free government. They've been over there in Europe fighting, and they want for free liberty, and they wanted part of it in the United States.
And this may be in your book, but I read so much about other stuff that maybe it's not. But on that bus that was taking him from where he was discharged in Georgia home to South Carolina, there were black and white soldiers.
Absolutely, and on the bus,
and
yes.
They were interacting in a way that some of the civilian passengers and the bus driver were uncomfortable with, because they'd fought together.
Right. Now, the Army remained at that point segregated. Mm-hmm. However, this group going to Fort Gordon had come back from the Far East on a boat together. Mm-hmm. So they'd been on a boat. The time it took to go from the Far East through the Panama Canal to New York, they were put on a troop train and came down to Georgia. They'd been together for about 10 weeks. And they had developed, as you say, relationships. And it reflected a kind of pattern of behavior that the white bus driver and the white civilians found pretty shocking.
Yeah.
The soldiers, not surprising, they had just been discharged at the end of World War II. They were passing a bottle around. I mean, they were these were men, black and white, but they were American soldiers.
Right. And he, Sergeant Woodard, had asked the bus driver at some point in South Carolina if he could get off the bus for a moment to relieve himself, which I'm told was policy of Greyhound.
That was
Greyhound
policy.
Bus.
Greyhound, you had to accommodate the request of a passenger.
Because there were no bathrooms on the bus.
No bathrooms on the bus. And and he was supposed, the bus driver should have said, sure, hurry up. But he said, he cursed him, and he found it sort of insulting that this black man would presume to hold the bus up so he could go to the restroom. And so he cursed Woodard, and Woodard, to the shock of the bus driver, cursed him back and said, speak to me like I'm a man. I am a man just like you. The bus driver says, go ahead. He goes off the bus, comes back. They don't say anything. But in the next town, which is Batesburg, South Carolina, the bus driver, now no longer concerned with staying on schedule, goes looking for a police officer to have Woodard removed and arrested. And that puts him in the hands of Linwood Shull.
Linwood Shull was the police chief of a two-man police department.
Right, Andy, a Mayberry without Andy, right?
and he arrests Sergeant Woodard as he gets off the bus, or at some point while the bus is, because he's going on from Batesburg to Winsboro.
Oh, he's going to Columbia and then to Winsboro, right.
So Linwood Shull takes him off the bus, and while he is in custody, beats Sergeant Shull. For what reason?
I'm sure it was that Woodard did not seem sufficiently docile, but Woodard, he said to Woodard, have you been released from the Army? And Woodard says, yes, and he hits him again and says, yes, sir, it's yes, sir, and that leads to a fracas that leads to him to beating him and knocking him unconscious and then blinding him.
As you mentioned, Sergeant was in uniform.
Yes.
And he was a decorated officer.
Correct.
So he was wearing his
dress uniform.
And
yes.
His decorations.
There's no secret.
Right. So this is a police chief who you describe as somewhat on his way to obesity.
Right, middle age obesity.
and he takes it upon himself to...
Who had not fought in the war, by the way.
Yes, to beat this guy with a billy club. That was common for police in that era, evidently.
It's actually called a blackjack. We don't see them much anymore. The cops used to have a little pocket on their legs, and it was called a blackjack pocket. Okay. And this blackjack was it kind of looked like a billy club, but it was spring-loaded, and it was leather at the top with buckshot in it. It was very hard. And then it had the spring loaded, and it carried tremendous, tremendous force to it. And by the 1970s, it was banned universally because it was so dangerous. But that is what Isaac Woodard was beaten by.
Why did he choose to use that? What did you call it?
Blackjack.
Blackjack.
That's what. That's just the device used.
Why did he choose to use it on his eyes?
Well, there is. Woodard's account of this was that after he was beaten, I'm sure he was viewed as a resistor. He was not a yes-sir guy. He wasn't being docile. And something just enraged this officer, and he viciously beat Woodard. And as Woodard's account of it was, as he was knocked unconscious. And as he was getting up, the officer took the end of the blackjack and stabbed it into each of his eyes. That's Woodard's account. And I will say that as part of my work, I had a forensic pathologist analyze the medical records of Isaac Woodard and concluded that his account was correct. That's exactly what happened.
Wow. They left him in a jail cell overnight. This happened shortly after his arrest, this beating, is that correct?
I mean, literally, you know, minutes after.
Left him in the jail cell overnight because he had to be arraigned in court the next day.
For drunk and disorderly conduct.
Yes, and so they took him to court. He couldn't see allegedly could not see.
Probably had to be led over to the...
And he was found guilty of just drunk and disorderly conduct, and he had to pay blinded. He had to pay a $44 fine.
Actually, it was $50, but he didn't have $50 on him, and they eventually reduced the bond to $44.
Which is what he did have.
Which he did have on him, and I actually have, I went to Batesburg and got the court records, and I see it says $50 slash through 44.
Right.
So, yeah, it Woodard's account. Woodard ended up being, like, very accurate on his description. Everything we can corroborate on his account of what happened is proven to be true.
How quickly did news of this travel? As you said, it took place in 1946, I'm not exactly sure of the date.
February 12, 46. So he ends up, the next day, he's taken to the VA hospital in Columbia, which would be February 13th, 1946. And he's got a head injury. I mean, he's initially not very communicative. I mean, he's been viciously beaten.
Had amnesia for a while, right?
It's not clear if just head injury. You know, nobody knows diagnose it specific, but he's clearly not all there. And he is. The beating was so vicious. Shell broke his blackjack on him. I mean, it was broken. We have later accounts of the blackjack being seen by FBI agents as being broken, and it was tied to this incident. So he's in the VA hospital, and over a period of time of weeks, Woodard becomes more communicative and then tells, I'm presuming, I don't know this because it's not really in the medical record, he tells, I presume, some African-American orderlies about what happened to him. The word goes to James Hinton, the head of the NAACP in South Carolina. He sends an African-American reporter to interview Woodard to try to find out what's going on with this blinded black sergeant. He tells the reporter that information, and eventually it's relayed to the NAACP National Office in New York, and Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, gets personally involved. Eventually, Woodard, whose family had moved to New York, he goes to New York and goes into the NAACP office after he's released from the VA hospital. He's released, he's there like 6 weeks. These are really serious injuries. And he shares the story. The NAACP then starts sharing the story with the press, with Orson Welles. You just recounted that's Orson Welles. That was the last of four national broadcasts by Orson Welles.
Orson Welles had, of course, the actor director, and he was famous on radio for doing War of the Worlds. But this was several years after that, and he had just started a commentary program, and he was looking for material. And obviously, this I'm not going to say he didn't really support the sergeant. He probably did because he was fairly liberal. But he was looking for material to get ratings.
Correct. He was. You might recognize that. You look for good stories, right? They don't fall in your lap sometimes. But this one did for Orson Welles. You know, Orson Welles was 23 years old when he did Citizen Kane.
Right.
I mean, he was a remarkable talent, This was a huge event in Orson Welles' life.
We'll come back and talk about that. And then how this also led to Harry Truman getting involved and what came out of that in just a moment. Richard Gergel is our guest. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Richard Gergel is our guest. He is a U.S. District Judge in Charleston, South Carolina, sitting in the same courtroom as Judge J. Waitis Waring, the man who made it his mission in life after this trial of Sergeant Isaac Woodard took place. And Judge Gergel has written a book called Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Waitis Waring about this. And we were talking about Orson Welles, who found out about this story, and as he said in the little excerpt of his program on ABC Radio back in the 40s, he made it his mission to go after the police chief in Batesburg, South Carolina, for beating and blinding Sergeant Isaac Woodard. You say in his autobiography, or in his biography, he refers to that incident, that broadcast, as the most significant thing he did in his entire career.
It's actually four broadcasts. Okay. Over the summer of 1946. The first broadcast, they didn't know who had beaten him. They actually had the town wrong. They thought Woodard thought it was Aiken, South Carolina. You know, he's dragged off a bus. He thought he was in Aiken.
In fact, Orson Welles called him Woodward, but it
called him Woodward, and he originally said in the original broadcast it was Aiken. The leadership of Aiken was understandably disturbed by that, and Welles hired private investigators to go to South Carolina, and they identified. They didn't know who the officer was. They didn't know what the town was. So what that broadcast was, I told you I would find him. I found him. The town was Batesburg. The chief is Shull.
Wow. So then at some point, this gets the attention of the relatively new president of the United States,
yes,
Harry Truman. What was it about this case? Because there were marches around the country about this, in protest of this.
All kinds of protests.
And there were those broadcasts by Orson Welles. But what was it about this that he ordered his Justice Department, Harry Truman did, to investigate this and prosecute it?
Well, there were, as you say, Mike, there were events around the country as these returning African-American veterans came home and were, like Woodard, not willing to acquiesce to the Jim Crow practices of going to the back of the bus, of being extremely docile. They just were no longer willing to acquiesce to Jim Crow. So there were these reported incidents. The president was aware of them. There were several particularly terrible incidents where at Moores Ford, Georgia, four lynchings occurred, four people were killed. There was these horrible incidents going on. And in September of 1946, President Truman meets with a group of civil rights leaders to discuss these incidents. And the leaders wanted Truman to call Congress back into session to make lynching a federal crime. Now, lynching, anti-lynching legislation had been debated in Congress since the 20s, but never got passed. Amazingly, you can't make lynching a crime. And President Truman had been a strong advocate for the anti-lynching legislation as a senator. But he explained to those present, he said, you know, there's just not support in Congress for this, and I don't want to do something that's not going to be effective. And at that point, Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, the most important civil rights leader in America at the time, and Truman's biggest supporter in the civil rights community, stopped the discussion. He says, Mr. President, let me tell you the story of the blinding of Isaac Woodard. He then detailed the story, very similar, Mike, to what you just detailed to your audience, and Truman sat riveted. And there are accounts of this, multiple accounts. His face turned red. He's extremely upset. And he says, my God, I had no idea it was as terrible as this. So what got Harry Truman's attention? It was the battlefield decorated soldier. He was a commander of a battery in World War I. He loved soldiers. He was the commander-in-chief of the United States. There's something about this incident that resonated with him in a way that nothing else resonated.
So the Justice Department did investigate. The Justice Department.
Well, first of all, he writes a letter. The president writes a letter the next day. I have the letter.
Okay.
In which he tells the Attorney General of the United States about this blinding and makes it clear the time for federal action has now arrived because the Justice Department was not prosecuting these cases.
So they do prosecute. And
they do.
This ends up in Judge Waitis Waring's courtroom in the same district in which you now preside. And the jury acquits the police chief. Describe the trial and the conduct of both the U.S. attorney and the defense attorney?
Well, it's, you know, the commander-in-chief may order the prosecution, but he doesn't go down there and try the case.
Right.
And there's a noticeable lack of skill and enthusiasm in the entire Justice Department down to the U.S. attorney's office about prosecuting this case. They're woefully unprepared. Poorly investigated. The FBI had been an unenthusiastic partner in investigating it. There was just a lot of institutional racism and institutional resistance to civil rights prosecutions. These were very rare in 1946.
Because the U.S. attorney did not come down from Washington, D.C. to try this case.
No, he's a South Carolinian,
yes.
Politically connected guy.
Yes.
Claude Sapp, by all accounts, an excellent lawyer. He didn't have his heart in this. They sent a lawyer from the Justice Department. He shows up the day before the trial. I mean, they're not prepared. They haven't done the work.
The defense attorney, you report, shouts racial epithets at Woodard, his client, during the trial.
And it's awful.
And he told the white jury, the all-white jury, that, quote, if you rule against Shull, the police chief, then let this South Carolina secede again. What kind of a defense is that, and why did that not lead to a mistrial?
Well, Judge Waring constantly called down the defense lawyers for their conduct. If Judge Waring had declared a mistrial, then the Justice Department would have never tried the case again.
Okay.
I mean, they were going to get a verdict in that case. And mistrials at that time for something like this were pretty unusual. But Judge Waring would later describe the trial as horrible, miserable, and he constantly admonished the jury to disregard the comments of the defense lawyers.
Explain this. You talked about the reluctance on the part of the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney and the FBI to investigate and then prosecute and then try the police chief and all this. And you talk about the institutional racism. Judge Waring was part of South Carolina. He's the son of a Confederate soldier.
Literally.
Yes.
Literally.
So what was it about this miscarriage of justice that set him on this quest that was essentially his epiphany in all of
it? It was something about he described watching Woodard led to the witness box by a court bailiff with sunglasses on. That image of this, mm-hmm. you know, young, robust soldier blinded. And then he described in very unemotional detail what happened to him. And Waring knew it was true. He could hear the account. He knew it was credible. And when the system failed to do justice, to hold the officer accountable, it shattered all of Judge Waring's perhaps naive assumptions about justice. But he had them, and it shattered them right before him.
The New York Times, in writing about your book, references the newly revived play on Broadway right now, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird and Atticus Finch, which people are coming, and it's been rewritten and restaged. So people are coming to that play and having their eyes opened about a period in American history that either they didn't really know about or they didn't realize just how bad it really was.
Or how recent it was.
Yes, and what they say in the Times about this is that Atticus Finch is fiction.
And this guy's the real thing.
And Judge Waring is the real thing.
Right.
Yeah, because this opened Judge Waring's eyes. Perhaps he'd seen all this before, but something about this clicked.
People have said to me, well, he lived in this segregated city. Of course, Charleston was one of the most segregated cities in America. This has been, you know, where the first shot of the Civil War had been fired. And
where the defense attorney is calling for secession again.
Right. I mean, so Judge Waring, but he came home. The trial was actually in Columbia. He came into Columbia to try the case. And he went back home, and he and his wife had been there at the trial. And she had never had any more interest in civil rights issues than he did.
Right.
But both of them were shattered by this experience. And they came home. And it was a time where white Charlestonians just couldn't talk about race and justice. You couldn't talk. There was no space in Charleston in the white community for that kind of discussion. And so the Warings decided that they would just do a private self-study. And they began reading books and there were a lot of cutting-edge books right after World War II. And they read them together. In fact, he would come home from court at night, and his wife would read a chapter from a book out loud to him. And then they would drive around Charleston, and they would talk about what they just read. Many people have said, well, what did they read? What were they reading? Well, they read W.J. Cash's Mind of the South, a Charlotte boy, by the way, who wrote that, and it was a really important book of that era. And then they read Gunnar Myrdal's The American Dilemma. The American Dilemma was a study funded by the Carnegie Foundation, headed by Gunnar Myrdal, who would later win the Nobel Prize, among other things, for this remarkable book, candidly telling, it's 1,400 pages long. The Warings read it together. And when they finished that, there was no turning back. Mm.
This incident and this trial and the awakening of Judge Waring led to a lot of different things, directly and indirectly. The end of segregation, the advancement of civil rights for black people. Some people say that this move toward justice would have happened anyway, that it was inevitable. Are you saying that it would not have happened without this case?
Well, let me say, in 1946, as the war ends, there are a lot of people who say, we got to break this Gordian knot of Jim Crow. People trying to figure out, in the Supreme Court, in the leadership of the Truman administration, in academia, and no one could figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. And who would figure it out? But this patrician judge from Charleston, yes, whose father, his daddy, was a Confederate veteran. It would have been the last guy in the world. And what does he do? There's this major segregation case, school desegregation case, Briggs versus Elliott. I detail how Judge Waring persuaded Thurgood Marshall to change the case from one that simply sought to use the separate but equal doctrine to equalize school facilities to a frontal attack on segregation. And when he did that, that case in Briggs versus Elliott was the first frontal challenge to segregation in American history.
It's an important case because it led to some of the language in the Brown v. Board of Education, a case that the Supreme Court took up. I don't think many people know about Briggs versus Elliott. What was that case about?
Briggs v. Elliott arose from Somerton, South Carolina, Clarendon County, a poor, predominantly African-American county. White folks were a distinct minority but had all the land, all the wealth in the community. And a group of very stalwart African-American citizens went to their school board and said, the white children have a school bus. We want a school bus. Mm-hmm. Our children can't get to school. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. And that led to a lawsuit that eventually sought to challenge the unequal, not only the school lack of the school bus, but school facilities generally. When the case came before Judge Waring, it was on Judge Waring's docket. By this point, Judge Waring had reached the conclusion that that Plessy versus Ferguson, the separate but equal doctrine, was morally, historically, and legally wrong. And he wanted to overturn Plessy.
And he also thought that if the Supreme Court took another look at it, they would overturn it.
He was highly confident that that would be the result. So he orchestrates getting this case before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a three-judge panel decision. At his suggestion, Marshall makes this frontal attack on segregation. It causes the creation of a three-judge panel in which the appeal went directly to the Supreme Court, bypassing the Court of Appeals. Judge Waring was in a minority of the three-judge panel, wrote the dissent for the ages. He described segregation as inherently evil, a violation of the 14th Amendment, and he had the memorable phrase, segregation is per se inequality. His language ends up being the language of Brown.
Right, and how unusual is that for a lower court decision and the language used in that decision to be incorporated into a Supreme Court?
Well, Briggs is part of there are five cases that make up Brown, okay, and one of them is Briggs. And there are 14 different judges in these various cases that come out of Virginia and Delaware, Kansas, of course, Topeka, that's the Brown case. And Briggs, they're all part of that case. So, and what is long forgotten because the name is called Brown, Thurgood Marshall argued Briggs v. Elliott. That's the case he personally argued. His assistant Bob Carter argued Brown v. Board of Education. They all saw Briggs as being the important case, and they saw Judge Waring's dissent as the model.
Judge Waring began to issue, after his epiphany, began to issue these decisions from the bench that really would have a major impact on the country.
Voting rights, and particularly area of voting rights, yes.
Should that tell us that when people complain about legislation from the bench, that that's what this is?
It's not that, because all Judge Waring was doing on these voting rights cases, you know, South Carolina had the only election that mattered in South Carolina, was a one-party state, was the white South Carolina Democratic Party primary. It was an all-white primary. African Americans were prohibited from participating. Judge Waring declared that practice unconstitutional under the 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution. He wasn't legislating from the bench. He was enforcing the Constitution. And nobody would argue that. And not only—
Was he an activist judge then?
I don't think he was any more activist, because at that time, there was already a U.S. Supreme Court case, Smith versus Allwright, that had ruled that the Texas white primary was unconstitutional. He was merely enforcing precedent in the 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Only people who would say it was, you know, it was activist were those who were trying to maintain segregation.
Did these decisions coming from his bench, his pen, his mind, have more weight because they were coming from a Southern judge in a Southern courtroom, even though it's a U.S. District Court in South Carolina? Did they have more weight?
He's from Charleston, right? Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt that the resonance of that great dissent, the Briggs versus Elliott dissent, was because who he was and where he came from.
It's the 1940s and the 1950s.
He retires by 1952.
Okay,
correct.
That all this is taking place, and in the title of your book is Unexampled Courage, which is something displayed by several people, among them Judge Waring. Here he is, the son of a Confederate veteran, highly prominent in the community, in Charleston, South Carolina.
Hard to imagine anyone more prominent.
The birthplace of the Confederacy. What was at stake for him? What happened to him because of these decisions?
Well, he was ostracized in his community. People he had known all his life would not speak to him. He had death threats constantly. So there were so many of them that the United States Attorney General ordered the Marshal Service to provide 24-hour protection. Literally, they lived at his house. I mean, they were feared for an assassination attempt. A cross was burned in his yard. Bricks were thrown through his living room window. There was a genuine fear he would be assassinated. There would later be these very courageous Southern judges, Frank Johnson in Montgomery, J. Skelly Wright in New Orleans, Judge McMillan here in Charlotte in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But in 1947, 1948, when Judge Waring starts issuing these voting rights decisions, there's nobody anywhere like Judge Waring. He's out there all by himself, as he was when he did the great dissent. He was there by himself.
Did he consider himself courageous very quickly?
Probably not. He probably considered he was just doing his duty. He always thought he was just upholding the rule of law.
U.S. District Judge Richard Gergel is our guest. His book is called Unexampled Courage. We'll come back and talk more about this extraordinary chapter in American history in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Judge Richard Gergel, U.S. District Judge in Charleston, South Carolina, is our guest. He's written a book about another judge sitting in the same courtroom, in the same building, back in the 1940s and 50s, Judge Waitis Waring. A book is called Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Waitis Waring. We're going to talk more about Judge Waring, but let me go back to the President Truman for just a couple of seconds, because this incident, the blinding of this police sergeant on his way home from World War II by a police chief in Batesburg, South Carolina, caught the attention of Harry Truman, who was appalled by what had happened. He had inherited Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, a coalition that included both segregationists and black voters in critical states. Truman ignored advice to stay out of this incident. He went on to establish the first presidential committee on civil rights, and here he is addressing the NAACP about the work of that committee.
As a first step, I appointed an advisory committee on civil rights last December. Its members, 15 distinguished private citizens, have been surveying our civil rights difficulties and needs for several months.
And the NAACP was a little miffed by how long all this was taking, but ultimately that committee would recommend the desegregation of the United States military, which Truman went on to order. That order came down in 1948. 2 years after this incident in South Carolina with Sergeant Woodard. That seems to have happened at the speed of light. Would that be an accurate assessment?
And he did it, Truman did it, in the middle of the presidential campaign, where race was a huge issue.
Yes.
The Dixiecrats. He showed, I mean, he's among the people I would describe as showing unexampled courage. And his decision to appoint the Civil Rights Committee arose out of the meeting in which he learned the story of Isaac Woodard. After telling the Attorney General of the blinding of Isaac Woodard and the need to act, he says, but we need to do more than that. We need to appoint the first Presidential Committee on Civil Rights. He does it within weeks thereafter. He mentions in that tape the 15 members. He didn't put any segregationists on there. He was going to do something. And when that report came out, he publicly embraced it. It led to the Dixiecrats running against him, his Civil Rights Committee, his embracing of those proposals. And there's a great line told, Strom Thurmond was the Dixiecrat candidate for president, and a reporter asked then-Governor Thurmond, they said, why are you mad with Harry Truman? His platform in the Democrat Party's platform is exactly as Franklin Roosevelt, and you supported Roosevelt. He says, yeah, the problem is Harry Truman really means it.
Hmm.
He did. He meant it. And not only did he order, by executive order, the desegregation of the military, in his second term, he used extensive efforts and attention and his own authority to completely desegregation of the military. So when he left office, 95% of the African-American troops were in desegregated units. It was basically the beginning of the end of Jim Crow in America.
I'm trying to remember presidential history, and I can't remember it. Did he pay a price for that? Is that why he didn't go on to his own second term? He had a second term because he inherited the role from President Roosevelt.
Right. Probably Korea was the reason he didn't run for a third term. But that led to the Dixiecrat campaign.
Right.
But it was long forgotten. Harry Truman carried 8 of the 12 Southern states. I mean, he went out there, famous whistle stop campaign. And there are a lot of people admired Harry Truman very much. He went to Texas. Everybody said, oh, man, he's desegregated the military. He's integrating the military. He's not going to get any votes. He carried every county in Texas. I mean, he was one heck of a retail politician. Mm-hmm. And everybody had counted him out. Now, what's really interesting, in December of 1948, he's just won the presidency, beat back this Dixiecrat effort. And down in South Carolina, J. Waitis Waring is issuing these civil rights decisions. What does Harry Truman do? He invites Waitis Waring to the White House. Do you think he was sending a message to the South?
Mm.
Here's the most reviled white man in the white South, and he's inviting Truman to the White House.
Why don't we know more?
I mean,
Waiting
Waring to the White House.
If he, and I'm not questioning you, if he was the most reviled white man in the South and he was issuing these groundbreaking decisions that led to the kind of world in which we live today, which is very different from what was going on in the 1940s, why don't we know more about him? Why isn't his name more well known?
Well, it's a great story, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I thought the story of all these folks, the role of Harry Truman in the civil rights movement is not widely known. The story of Judge Waring, the story of the courageous plaintiffs in Briggs v. Elliott who suffered tremendous retaliation, their story is not widely known. So part of my mission here was to tell this story because I think it teaches us a lot about today and about the role of civic engagement and civic courage.
Martin Luther King, I'm not sure he originated the phrase, but he certainly said that the arc of justice leans, the arc of history leans toward justice.
Right. The arm of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Judge Waitis, you follow him in his courtroom, and the building now bears his name because Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina, his name was on that courthouse.
And we were very honored to have Senator Hollings' name on our courthouse.
And he recommended that his name be removed and replaced by Judge
Waring.
Why?
Well, in 2011, I helped organize a conference on Judge Waring because I wanted Charlestonians and South Carolinians to know this story. Senator Hollings attended. He was a great friend of mine. And he came. He knew Judge Waring very well. And he told me at that time in 2011 he had always intended to name the courthouse for Judge Waring. He was looking for the right time to do it. And he said he told me this story. He says he came in one day into the office and he was told that the night before, Senator Thurmond had put an amendment to a bill that named a lake up in the upstate for himself. That is, Lake Greenwood became Lake Thurman. And he was named, his courthouse was named for him. And he said the thing just took off and there was no way I could stop it. He says, but I feel like he was, you know, then 90 years old. He says, I want to do something about this. And eventually he went to Senator Graham and to Congressman Clyburn and said, I want my name removed from the federal courthouse, and Wade is Waring replaced it. Congress did it. And I called the General Services Administration, which owns our courthouse, and I said, we're going to do this program rededicating the courthouse. Could you send me a model program? They said, Judge, no one in America has ever asked their name to be removed from a courthouse.
Wow. In 1957, this is 6 years after the trial and, 5 years after he retired, Judge Waring appeared on a PBS program called Open Mind. He was on a panel with Dr. Martin Luther King. This is the very beginnings.
And by the way, King is 27 and Judge Waring is 77.
Wow. This is the very beginning of the civil rights movement, the big Martin Luther King push towards civil rights. And on that program, Judge Waring said that he believed Southerners would accept integration, though not many were willing to talk about it.
There are very, very few that are willing to come out in the open and say so. There are a great many, in my opinion, who would be glad if they are made to do it.
Was he right about that, or was that wishful thinking on his part? Because he'd been, as you say, ostracized. He was even driven out of the South. He was living in, the North by that time?
He's living in New York City at the time. Here was his view. In his voting rights decisions, he had initial defiance, and he summoned all the members of the Executive Committee of the Democratic Party to his courtroom in Charleston. And he told them, listen, I'm going to explain something to you. If you defy, you are in defiance of my order. You are in contempt. If you do this again, I will have a federal judge faced with contempt has two choices, a fine or jail. I want you to know that if you violate my orders again, there will be no fines. People were stunned. Here was Wade is Waring threatening to jail white men for violating the rights of black citizens. But you know, it worked. He broke the resistance. And he believed that he passionately supported the original Brown v. Board decision, save for one issue, all deliberate speed. He thought that remedy, which was really Brown 2, was wrong. He thought they should have immediately implemented desegregation and that the South would have accepted it. And that's really what he's talking about in 1957. He had said it many other times, which is, I think if you draw a line and make clear what the rule is, people will obey it in the South.
Was he right?
You know, we don't know. I think eventually there was compliance with civil rights rulings. It took an awful long time. Yeah. But the answer is yes, I think he was right.
I would imagine that, I'll ask you, why should I put words in your mouth? You're sitting right here. You're a federal judge. You're sitting in the same courthouse as this judge you wrote this book about. His name is on the front door of this courthouse. Did that in some way heighten your interest in doing all the work that it took to do this book is impeccably researched. So it took a lot of work to put this book together. Did that, the fact that you're sitting in his courtroom, play a role in your interest in this?
Well, clearly when I was coming to Charleston, I had practiced law in Columbia for 30 years. I had an interest in Judge Waring, but obviously it was heightened by me and Charleston being in the courthouse where he had presided. And the decision to organize the conference in 2011 was clearly motivated by a desire that this story be better known. And that really, my work on that led, first we did a statute honoring Judge Waring. Attorney General Holder came down for that. And then the change of the name of the courthouse. By the time we were doing the courthouse, I was well into the book, naming of the courthouse, I was well into the book. But all of it, you know, you can't help. But when you're in Charleston in the courthouse where Jay Wade is Waring presided, you can't help but be inspired by a higher calling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that clearly motivated my desire to do this book and to do it as well as I could.
Again, let's go back to World War II and something you almost began this conversation with, this fact that the 900,000 African Americans served in some capacity in the military during World War II, usually in menial tasks. Some got to fly airplanes and things like that. Still, that service opened the door to opportunities for those men that would never have existed.
Leadership, training, et cetera. Yes.
Education, they acquired valuable skills, marketable skills, and they saw a world beyond what they could possibly have imagined in the narrow world they were forced to live in here in the Jim Crow.
Particularly African-American troops in Europe were treated with great dignity.
Yes.
And they saw a world in which the color of their skin was not the defining characteristic of their lives. It was a very big impact on them.
And they served the country. Let me underline the word served. They served the country. And when they came back, they expected many of them, most of them, to be treated with respect, the respect that they had earned through their service.
And Mike, that's why they became the foot soldiers of the Civil Rights Movement,
yeah.
these veterans.
Did it take this incident to drive that point home to Americans who didn't see it that way? The fact that these guys had served, they'd done their part, and they deserved a role in society.
Well, it's hard to point to one incident. I know that Isaac Woodard received a great deal of attention in the African-American community because he was viewed as a heroic figure, someone who had survived a vicious racial beating and then who went around the country and told that story. So he was widely admired. I was with Joe Delane last evening at the Levine Museum. Joe is the son of Reverend Delane, the leader of the plaintiffs in the Briggs case. And he talked about, he was a Korean veteran. He says he knew the story of Isaac Woodard as a young black man and that he was very inspired by it.
Woodard was blinded at a very young age, 27, I believe.
Right, he was 27.
What was his life like after that?
His family had moved to the Bronx, and he moved there. In his initial years, he struggled. The government did not give him, the military did not give him a full pension, saying, well, you weren't in the military when you were blinded. Literally was still in uniform, but had not arrived home, but had been discharged. That would later change in 1961. Congress changed that law. Woodard would then get a full disability benefit, and he qualified for VA housing benefits. He bought a home. And he eventually acquired some rental property. He was I've come to know his family. Mm-hmm. And they said that after a few years of this, in which he had been very bitter, he just put it aside. He says, I just can't live with all this hate. And he never talked about the incident again. And what is really kind of tragic about this, beyond his blinding, is he never knew about the impact on President Truman and on Judge Waring. And let me just go back.
How could he not know that?
This story was not widely known. That's a major part of this book, is his impact on Judge Waring and President Truman. And let me go back to that talk when Waring and Truman meet in the White House. Truman starts the conversation by saying, Judge, do you know the story of the Negro sergeant from South Carolina? And Judge Waring said, Mr. President, I tried that case.
Wow.
And that's how they began their discussion.
What about Chief Scholl? What happened to him?
Nobody in Batesburg ever remembered that he had been prosecuted for the blinding of an African-American soldier. He lived on to be 92 years old. He was remembered as the elderly usher at the Methodist Church. Everyone's shocked when they hear this story.
I only have 90 seconds, full minute left. Your book is about the courage of one judge because of his change of heart and the decisions that resulted. But in your years on the bench, you overturned South Carolina's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. You overturned death sentence because the prosecutor compared a black defendant to King Kong, and you presided over the trial of Dylann Roof, in which you sentenced him to death. That probably didn't take courage, but the other two did, didn't they?
I don't really talk about my cases, Mike. I feel like I ought to talk my cases ought to be what I say in the courtroom and on my orders, so I will leave to others to comment on that. Obviously, Judge Waring is a heroic figure, not just by me, but by many of my colleagues around the United States, and he's a great model for courage and for upholding the rule of law and the Constitution of this country.
So what can we learn from this story?
I think the biggest lesson here is the power of the rule of law, of judicial independence, and the need to uphold the Constitution of the United States.
Do you worry about the future of the rule of law?
I got to say, I know my colleagues well. I don't think, I'm very optimistic about the future.
Judge Richard Gergel, the author of Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Truman, and Judge Wittes Waring. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.